Elizabeth, thank you so much for being here today. I'm very excited to talk to you anytime, but especially as we approach Mother's Day, to talk about your journey from so many things. We're going to talk about all of it, but where it has landed now, where you are an educational advocate, you are running for re-election at the local school board, some of the amazing things you've done in your first term. I can't wait to talk about all of it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
Wonderful. So I know that you know, you've had a really interesting life. We've started talking about some of those items, and I'm curious to start sort of the role that education has played in your life.
Okay, so education is very special for me. It's absolutely transformed my life. Just to give you a little bit of my background, my parents immigrated here back when the minimum wage was $1.60 an hour, and they moved into an apartment with assorted relatives, an apartment that cost $240 a month, which was a huge sum, because when you're making $1.60 an hour, you needed everyone working to be able to afford it. But over time, obviously my parents had children, and we went to the local school there. That's PS 130 in what was then Little Italy, now Chinatown. And that was my first introduction to English language classes. You know, in my family, we spoke Cantonese, and suddenly you get dropped in school, and everyone's speaking in English. And that was back when all the forms were in English, or possibly maybe Spanish on the other side. But even though like a third of the school were like Chinese kids, Cantonese kids like me, there was only one Chinese teacher in the whole school. And that was the person that everyone in my class was like, oh my goodness, you know, we have a chance to be like her, you know, Miss McQueen, we would be able to, you know, know enough to be able to teach somebody else. So that's my first, I guess, recollection of what it was like to see a teacher that looked like me, a teacher who could teach me things that that my family wasn't able to teach. And she was coincidentally also a ballet instructor. So I also took ballet lessons with her. But being in the school, like in PS 130, just to give you an idea, in those days they ranked all the public schools in New York City. Mm-hmm. And so that was a school that was ranked kind of pretty near the bottom, like 400 plus out of 600 elementary schools at the time. And my parents were really, really worried, because there weren't, you know, this was a city school. There was hardly any outdoor space. If you had to do anything in physical education, we ran on the roof.
Oh, wow.
so this was a city school. It was an urban environment. And so they worked really hard. They saved up money. And at that time, it was really hard to buy a home because they had no major credit history. They made money that was mostly cash, so you have to save up to have a big enough down payment so that the banks would be, you know, willing to lend the rest to you. But they were able to move into a home in Brooklyn. And the remarkable story there is that it was only possible because the woman who passed away left her house to the Catholic Church. Yeah. And it was the church that sold it to us.
Oh, wow.
So that was our first step into a suburb, not a suburb, it's still Brooklyn, you know, but into a non, like, highly densely populated school. It was such an extraordinary experience. Class sizes went from, I don't know, 35 to 25. It just seemed like, oh my goodness, you know, like, it was such a sea change, and made me realize there's a lot more to learn. Like, I thought I was doing well enough. I got, you know, good grades and everything in New York City, in Manhattan, and then I went to Brooklyn. It was different. There was a lot more writing. There was a lot more critical thinking. One of my favorite recollections was everybody getting the New York Times every Tuesday, and we would have to underline who, what, when, where, why, and how, and look for the facts and the opinions and the substantiated statements. And, you know,
wow. If only kids were still doing this.
In order to do that, right? And we did that in third grade. It was so, like, eye-opening. Like,
yeah.
Definitely it's not something that we did in Manhattan, Chinatown. We did this in Brooklyn, and it was like, wow, I can read everything this way. Wow, you know, like, what a shocker. And it was just, my eyes were just continuously opened. You know, I can read things, you know, use this structured framework to help me grasp the facts. I remember one day, you know, you hear, you know, things about science class and suddenly realized that the planets they were talking about was referring to the planet I'm on and the relative to other. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is not like stuff I've just memorized. This is real, you know. And It just continued to open my eyes to just how much bigger the world is out there. And then after a few years, it was a tough place to live though, because we were the first family of color to move into that part of Brooklyn, and not all the kids were nice.
Oh, I'm sure.
but I had some wonderful neighbors. I had a neighbor who lost a finger in who served in World War II, and but played the clarinet still, and that was my first introduction to an orchestral instrument. Mm. And I was like, oh wow, you know, it made sounds. He played jazz. It was like never seen that before. You never see that kind of instrument in a city school system, right? And then my parents, again, they kept saving money to try to move us to better and better school districts. So we went from 400 plus in New York City schools to number 14.
Oh wow!
Where we were in Brooklyn, so it was a big leap. I think it might have just jiggled between 14 and 28 the time that I was there. But then my parents asked around, and someone said, no, you should move to Syosset, Long Island. And my parents didn't really know anything about Syosset, but they found the smallest house that they could find and just to get us into the schools, and we moved out there. And that was mind blown. Suburban school district, completely, like, not like anything and everything. There were sports fields, you know. Mm. There was a music program where people gave you instruments to play until you're ready to commit to private lessons or buying your own instrument and such. And it was just such a completely different world. Just the amount of attention, the amount of resources that were available, the teachers that I had definitely changed the way that I think. One of my favorite teachers were my English and my history teachers. And I remember learning about the U.S., you know, government and the civics process and thinking, oh, this is nice to know. Not sure when I'll ever apply it. And little did I know. Little did I know that there would be like so many opportunities, that how important it is. I think if anything, the awareness of the importance of civic life and participating in it as a volunteer for most of us. Mm-hmm. Our country was designed that way. It's not made where, like, we were living abroad, you would have a ministry that would have a set budget that would take care of things. But America still runs on the generosity of time and attention and care of its citizenry. It is remarkable. It would be, one, it would stop working if we didn't have it. But two, it's like, it is so much richer for it as well, because it truly then reflects the priorities and the, what the community thinks is important and what the community can help bring, you know, to bear to it as well. So I'll just maybe stop there. There's been a lot more transformative experiences in education, but that's kind of my, you know, short background and why I just feel like it's really important to, you know, bring these opportunities to other kids, pay it forward. Somebody paid it for it for me. I had great school board members that made sure my school was wonderful, and they were invisible to me. I didn't know anything about them. And then now you're like, oh, wow, you know, they were doing all this hard work. And probably nobody will remember, at least no child will remember, you know, like exactly, you know, who, what my name was and such. But it's valuable, and I'm very grateful for the privilege to participate in that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like that's the biggest surprise of adulthood is everything that felt effortless and magical. It's, oh no, it was just adults working. Quietly, silently pouring themselves into you.
Yes. And it's like, and here's a child, you're like, no, everything is working or everything revolves around me.
Right.
Right. That's the other one. And it just seemed like magic. And now, being someone who is volunteering, I try to help our children to be aware. It's like, hey, remember, this is the effort, you know, thank the people over here, over there. But also think about, you know, if this is something that you will want to do, because it's, you know, like I said, it, would not work, you know, if people didn't step up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, for me, I feel like education was the unlock for me as well. I grew up very poor. There was no other pathway by which I could move from where I was born to where I wanted to be, except for hardworking teachers in public school that, like, you know, turned on light bulbs and created those aha moments and ignited, like, you know, as you were talking about, like, the planets, they're actually that. Like, I remember having those moments, and certainly English was my favorite subject. So, like, the English teachers that would introduce you to the right book at the right time that just, like, it, like, exploded your mind. Suddenly you could think about things you couldn't even imagine prior. It's just so powerful. There's nothing like the schools in this country. Yes. But it sounds like you have been involved in schooling in other places. Yes. You have a long history of service in education.
So it's very interesting. That was itself an interesting journey. So as you, I'm sure you saw that I was previously in the financial services. And even that was not a straight line. I kind of, you know, wandered around. I think my priority coming out of college was to just pay off those college loans.
Yes. Right, oh my goodness, yes.
Right, that was just like, that was the objective. And then once you did that, you're like, so what do I do now, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started in research, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, this is nice. But I really liked being able to articulate things, to especially complex concepts, and explain them either in marketing and then eventually to clients. And eventually the role that I wound up in was mainly with client training. Mm. And I found it really, really rewarding because most of my clients, because I was in asset management, and most of my clients were nonprofits. They were central banks. They were supranationals. They were pension funds. And I just loved working for them because I knew I was doing good. Like, I wasn't just doing well, I was doing good.
Yeah.
I was making sure that people who worked hard and put their money aside in the national pension scheme or the national social security scheme were going to get a good return that they could rely on when they're ready to bring it out. I just felt like this was a wonderful place to be where there were none of the scary conflicts of interest that I heard so much about. You know, I was like, I'm doing well and I'm doing good. This is what, you know, this is great. But it was sometimes, like, I think harder for the people, for my clients who were generally, a lot of them were, you know, could be low level, you know, civil servants or, maybe a few people in the research area that I would speak to. But it was hard for them to see the bigger picture of that. And I wanted to also inspire them, motivate them to see this is the good work that you're contributing to. So I really enjoyed that training aspect. The other thing that happened was that I actually managed to start some teaching when I was working as well. I was working full time, which meant long hours. And at that time, there was a part of me that was really drawn to wanting to go back for divinity school. Mm. I'm a big believer in knowing what I believe in. I know as much as possible, but really knowing. And I was like, how could I do this? How could I take time? And do I have to stop working? Do I have to save up and then go to divinity school? Or do I find a way to read on my own? And someone told me about this nonprofit. It's based in the U.S., Bible Study Fellowship. But they provide just Bible study. That's it, you know. All over the world. I think they have thousands of classes at this point, maybe about 600,000 people being trained every year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a great group, but it's really meant to, you know, to study together and do that. And I was like, oh, that sounds like a good deal. I can do this and still work and try to figure out how to find that balance. And that balance worked, like, throughout the entire 10 years that I was working, continues on to this day. I'm no longer teaching. I've taught everything from 6-month-olds to the grown-up classes. But now I'm an administrator for the Westchester classes. And it's just great to see people who are motivated, who carve out the time themselves to come and study together and work together. And I feel that's it's been a real privilege to serve there as well. But again, it's about learning and about applying what you learn. And I'm excited. I'm excited when I see adults do it, when I see kids do it, because I know I know it means better things. I know they get to know themselves better, to get to know more of what they can do and what they're capable of and what, you know, what their next calling in life might be. And that can only be a good thing.
Oh, I love it. And I love like the connection you make between education and power in the best sense, like empowerment, that is the thing that will continue to pull you along your journey. Like it will reveal to you what is next, what you need to know, what the next thing you need to learn is, because learning is never done.
It's really great. And sometimes it's okay to not know everything, but you have picked up maybe enough skills over here, like maybe a structure or a process that you can apply to your next step. And that will open up your eyes or open up a door to some other skill or skill set or you know, opportunity set that you can then move forward and then you end up in a place you never expected, which is kind of like where I am here. But after 10 years at Goldman Sachs, it was I had my second child. It was during a great financial crisis when I was retrenched and my husband was retrenched at the same time.
Oh, geez.
And that was a shock, especially for someone who expected to work and was afraid of not working. And I really had to... I was really afraid. My husband and I really, were of different minds on this. It was remarkable. And I love the example that he set for me. I think my first instinct, having grown up with very little, was hunker down, like, you know, pull down the shades, you know, cut off all the bills, find out how to, like, survive and on your savings and stuff. And my husband's attitude was just such an incredible, like, trusting attitude. He's like, we will never have this much free time without family again. Yes. Right, that was it. I was like, really? You know? And I'm like, no, don't you see? In the future, all we could get is like a week here or 2 weeks here, but we now have months. And I'm like, okay. You know, like months of not working is exactly what I was afraid of, you know? Right. But he's like, no, let's do this. And, you know, we went somewhere every month. I think our first trip was back, we were in Singapore, we went back to Hong Kong, and I had just cut off my cell phone service in Hong Kong thinking I was cutting expenses and not realizing I would need the phones anyway, so that's a lesson to me. But then we also went to visit his grandfather, which we didn't realize at the time would be our last time seeing him.
Oh.
Yeah, so he ended up getting sick and passing away before, shortly after our third child was born, but he didn't get a chance to see him. But then we went to Disneyland. we went to Phuket, and then we wound up in the end in New York. And at that time I was like, oh, you know, we don't know when we'll ever have the chance to come back to New York again, so let's just make this one trip. And he ended up interviewing here for a job that he ended up getting in Hong Kong. And so that was another lesson, that all these opportunities or all these, really it was an opportunity, are not wasted. I think we sometimes rob ourselves of the joy of learning when we are fearful, when we're really fearful. But when we open ourselves to what this change might mean, you know, we get something that's priceless. Yeah, I mean, that time really was the longest that we had, right? Like 6 months, you know, right? I mean, like, it's just unheard of. And so we were able to, after that trip, come back, move to Hong Kong, for various reasons, including having a third child. I just never could get myself back into the workforce again. And and it took me a few years to kind of get around, like, oh, you know, what do I do now? What do I do now? And my parents didn't know what to do with me either. They were like, aren't you going to go back to work? it was like not helping. But I had just never considered not working. And my husband was really, really patient with me. He's like, take your time, see what it is that you need to, to think about. You might have to relook at your priorities or what's important. And it turned out to be a really, really good thing. We didn't realize at that time, but our first two children are neurodiverse. Mm. And if I had not been at home, I might not have noticed it.
Yeah. You
know, I might not have been able to seek intervention as quickly. As it was, we were able to do like a lot of remarkable things. I don't think people would, you know, when they meet our children, would realize that they're neurodiverse. But, yeah, I'm grateful for that time, that really that time that I could spend with them. And as a result, I got involved with their education very closely because they were different learners. They didn't learn like everyone else. So, you know, for example, they would be much more into nonfiction than fiction, much more into logic than imaginary play, you know, much more into structured play or even sometimes repetitive play rather than like a very spontaneous, you know, type of play. And so all of that was like, oh, okay, let me rethink this. How do I introduce this subject if it wasn't introduced the same way that it was introduced to me? Like, how do I rethink this? How do I reframe it? How do I help them to see the excitement and what the purpose and what's good about the subject that might be really challenging for them? And I learned just so much through that as well. So I end up accidentally falling into the role of sort of a special needs advocate in Asia, where a lot of these resources are not clearly made available. They're wonderful in that they have resources available. The public health services in Hong Kong and Singapore are both incredible. Mm-hmm. And they both have education systems. There's a public education and private in both of those places. But it was still a pretty new field. Like, how do you address neurodiverse children in public school setting? Do you move them to special schools? Or, you know, what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? Went through all that. So I think what it taught me was really to be open-minded, because there was no one right fit for everyone. And we ended up with three kids in three different schools.
Oh, wow.
And the driving was incredible. Like, forget extracurriculars. Just driving from school to school to school was...
Yeah, that's a full-time job.
It was like, yes, it was like a full-time job. And at the same time, I was so grateful that they each had the right place for them.
Oh.
And so, you know, so grateful. I learned so much from each of the schools, serving sometimes in the schools, which was wonderful. Never expected to have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Because as an American overseas, obviously I'm not voting, and I didn't expect to be invited to play a role in that.
Yeah.
But if anything, I found that sometimes these environments surprise us in just delightful ways. I found them even more experimental, more open-minded, more willing to try things than that anyone had anticipated. I think one of the stereotypes is, you know, like, I was brought up with, learning to write Chinese language. I remember going to Chinese school as a young child and stopping because I was so afraid of the teachers and just like, oh, it's a scary place. I'm scared, you know, like, they're going to hit my hand if I don't do the strokes in the correct order. And that wasn't the case at all. My eldest went to a Chinese medium school in Hong Kong. And I was really worried because he's left-handed. And, you know, in the old days, left-handed was really bad. You forced left-handers to learn to write right-handed. And, like, we've tried different things. It wasn't happening. The only thing he does right-handed is play the violin. Everything else he does, you know, left-handed. And it was remarkable. The teacher says, oh, no problem. And she used her right hand to grab his left hand.
Aww.
And says, this is how we do it. And it's just wonderful to see, because it addressed my fear.
Yeah.
My fear that he wouldn't be seen, you know, and wouldn't be would be punished for being different, you know. And that didn't happen. I was so really, really grateful. And I just learned that in a lot of ways that they were much more flexible and progressive than I think the old stereotypes had led us to believe, which happens when you live overseas and haven't seen the developments over the past 20, 30 years.
Right.
Right? So I'm like, yeah, I can go back and say, no, it's not this way anymore. Yes. Actually, this is really, really great.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. And I do want to pivot in a moment to how that experience helped to inform some of the initiatives that you've put in place during your time on the Rhinex school board. But I do just want to take a moment to really recognize how amazing your husband's perspective was in that very terrifying moment when my instinct too would have just been like, contract fear. And I just love that he had the foresight to say, let's look at this as an opportunity instead of a problem.
I was was like really grateful.
Yes.
How does it, having to learn with different learners has been really joyful. It really, for one thing, as someone who grew up not having a lot of children my age and I'm sure you're familiar with this, especially when you're poor. Like, you don't have time for play dates. You don't have time to go anywhere. Like, my parents used to pick us up from school. My mom would bring us to the sweatshop where she was sewing, plop us on an empty sewing bench, right? And we would do all homework, right? You know, there was no way we were going to bring anybody else's kids to that environment, right? No. It was So I was just really unfamiliar with that kind of play. Like, what do you do with kids at that age, you know? And I was initially very anxious about having children. I didn't know what I was going to do with them, you know?
Yeah.
But after having our own and after working, working hard to learn more about them, then you realize, oh, the more I saw them in their uniqueness, the more I loved them. And I enjoyed them so much, I kept asking to do the kids program. Mm-hmm. I was already doing some of the kids program, but I was doing older kids, the ones that were a little more adult-like.
Yeah.
Right? So I was doing high schoolers. I enjoyed it so much. It was the group that everybody was afraid of initially, you know. But I was like, no, give me the high schoolers.
Yes.
I want the people who ask questions, you know, because I asked questions. But then after having my own babies and understanding their development and how they were, their eyes were being opened and how they were seeing the world and comprehending it and trying to apply, like, you know, apply what they like. Oh, is mommy still going to be there when I take, making sense of the world. I just enjoyed it and loved it more. So that's when I kind of like, okay, yes, give me the 6 months old. I'm not afraid of the 6 months old anymore. I'm not afraid of the 3 year olds anymore. I'm not afraid of, and kind of worked through all of it. And it made me very passionate about wanting to make sure that everybody else had the opportunities that I did. I was really fortunate in that I wasn't working. I wasn't working by the time I had kids, or by the time I had my second one, that I could go and really dig into all the public health papers and websites and figure out what services were being offered, and calling up the Ministry of Health or calling up the Ministry of Education and figuring out how to connect the dots. And then I would take that information. I realized, oh, you know, I'm not the only one with these questions. People who lived here all their lives had the same questions.
Yeah.
So I started putting that information up. You know, I started like answering questions and putting that. And it kind of like I fell into this role of just like being an advocate for children, for different learners, you know. And that continued from Hong Kong to Singapore. And then when we moved here, I mean, thank God our children had so much, intentional learning opportunities that they didn't require additional support when they moved here,
oh,
which
was great.
Remarkable.
It is remarkable.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And so I'm actually happy. If anybody's interested in the subject, please talk to me, because I'm actually really happy to share information about that. I still continue to do some of that. So I still continue to share with families, both in our district and outside of a district, you know, who are looking for ways to maximize learning opportunities for their different learners. But in our schools, we've just been really thrilled with our staff and, you know, the willingness of our board to support the initiatives that have made such a big difference, especially post-COVID. You know, we have a new director, not new anymore actually, but our director of pupil personnel came from Summers, and he joined us a couple of years back now, I think a little over 2 years now, and he, you know, recommended these additional services. We were, I think, definitely ahead of the curve at that time when he was there. I think more and more schools in our area are considering it, and in fact I think it may now be offered to all our schools in our area through BOCES going forward, but we were ahead of the curve there.
Yeah.
So that was really, really nice.
Good for you.
And that provided both additional learning opportunities but also mental and emotional health, and we realized that it wasn't just the kids that needed help, the families did too. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the program is incredible. They made learning opportunities available to the parents in English as well as Spanish, which I thought was
wow,
amazing, right? Really such a great thing. And you know, we have actually particularly good participation from the Spanish in the Spanish programs. So we're very, very grateful. I think as a small community where everyone knows each other, or, you know, kids of different ages are more likely to play with each other when you go to high school. We're not so big that you have to have all your classes of only people in your age group. It's actually quite common to be in classes and sports programs where there are children of different grades, where you're working closely with them. And that's actually really, really good for atypical learners. It's actually super, it's actually very, very healthy. I think from a pedagogical perspective, that's kind of more like how things used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's only in the really the late 20th century, late 19th century, and then through the 20th century, did we have these kind of like single classroom by year and, you know, kind of thing. And we lost some things in that, I think.
Absolutely.
And I really do appreciate what we have in our school district, where students have very regular, very frequent interaction and friendships with people of different age groups. So very, very grateful for that.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that you were able to help get those programs in place. I know that emotional and mental health is so important. It's something that, again, for like, I think when I was growing up, we didn't even use those words.
No,
like,
we didn't.
That just didn't exist. No. Kids were good or bad, and there was no concern for what might be going on.
Right, right. You know, that is, you know, that's exactly it. I mean, what would have been like had we had, you know, had that when we were growing up. I remember going back to, maybe this is a fun story. So when I graduated from high school, I went back to my first school. So from Sayasa High School, I wanted to visit my elementary school in PS 130 to kind of say, hey, you know, I'm going to college.
Yeah.
I got a lot of financial aid, and I was able to go to Yale. And so I was like, you know,
it's a big deal.
It's a big deal, right? That kind of thing. And I went back, and Mr. Kramer was gone. And it was the first year for this Chinese principal.
Mm, wow.
And we talk about when there was only one Chinese teacher when I first went to school there. And now I'm seeing a Chinese principal. It was like, mind blown. And she was like, you know, I've only been here for a few months, but just you wait. I'm going to make changes here. And she told me then, so I can't remember that she was, you know, that she was basically sharing this with a student, an alum, right? She says, I am going to send teachers back for additional education. I'm going to hire staff to hold their places. Everyone is going to come back with master's degrees or more, and it's going to change our school. And I thought, like, okay, yeah.
Right? Sure you will.
Right? I'm like, I have no idea what this meant.
Yeah.
It was huge. It was huge. So gives an idea how old I am, but when I went to see her, it was 1992. And by the time I came out of college, it was 1996. And by 2000, September 11, right? 2001. By 2001, that school, so we're talking about less than 10 years, had become one of the most sought after schools in the country, which is amazing because it was ranked really, really low, right?
Right.
What she also did, what I found out, was that she hired someone to focus on fundraising full-time, applying for grants, applying for additional resources to, you know, she ended up building a wing out of the tiny little strip of concrete that we had. Like, but I get it. She made additional, you know, classrooms available. And now all physical activity had to be on the rooftop. but it was huge. It transformed the school. And I remember, the reason why I remember this was because at September 11th, children on the rooftop could see the planes.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And it was very, very traumatic. And I think President Bush or he sent someone to come to the school.
Oh, wow.
And it was kind of noted because it was, by that time, it was a very, you know, like, it was still, I think they would, someone had written it was top 100 schools in the country, you know, elementary schools, you know. But it was, by that time, like, they had a lot more staff that was, you know, that were bilingual and, you know, in Chinese and English. And it was just a, like, it had been transformed. The school had been transformed. This principal had transformed the school. Children's lives have been transformed there. And I just felt like, oh, you know, I didn't know at the time that I first met her that I was going to be meeting a rock star.
Yeah.
And then fast forward more years, and I have children, and I'm in Singapore, and I start talking to educators in Singapore. And I mention, oh, yeah, and I went to school in PS-130. And they're like, oh, they send us on training trips there.
Wow.
So other countries with excellent school districts,
yeah, okay,
with excellent academic systems and standards and all that, they send their staff to come see our school.
Wow.
Right? About just what a difference administrators can make. Mm-hmm. How they can transform their environment. And I was like, wow, never thought. Who would have thought? You know, like it's just full circle. Never thought that it would, you know, I would have a conversation about that again. And then, of course, and I never thought we would move back to the U.S. That was a surprise after 20-something years abroad. And being, my husband asked me, what do you think about moving back to New York? And I'm like, okay. And we thought about, you know, like, you know, do we want to move in a city or do we want to move to Syosset? And we moved to, we ended up coming to Westchester because Westchester felt more like Syosset when I was growing up.
Mm.
That's kind of the feel that I had. But I brought the kids back to PS-130 and
nice.
Showed them, you know, showed them the school building outside, showed them the place that I like to eat across from the school, which is still there. Yes.
Oh, wow. Know? That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah, this Taiwanese chicken chop, pork chop place. It's still there. I love it.
So were they impressed? Were they like, oh, I get it?
Well, they're like, yes, this is really good. This is really good. And there's a great story even there because in the old days, with the early waves of migration of Chinese, they were largely men. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Men who came to work on the railroads, who came to the gold rush, who came to, work in factories. They were largely men. And so you find, I think people assume that men did all jobs in Chinese society, but it's just that there was a dearth of women.
Yeah.
that was really, and what was remarkable about this place was it came later. So this was a later wave of migration. So the initial waves of migration were generally Cantonese speakers in America. And then later waves were more Mandarin speakers. And this shop opened because this was a Taiwanese style, this Taiwanese proprietor that came and introduced a new flavor. And having eaten Cantonese all my life and getting the pickled vegetables and all this, I was like, oh, this is what I want.
Yes.
So, and it's still there. And it's still, and I'm just grateful for that little bit of, you know, history that I can still taste and share with other people.
Well, that's amazing. And I love just like sort of that arc of progress that, you know, from the school you started at to, you know, your parents wanting to move to a new area, to the new administrators, volunteers, teachers, parents, everyone learning, doing better and better, mm-hmm. so that our kids are getting a much better chances than we ever had, better understanding on everybody's part. It's just a really lovely story.
Thank you. Yeah, I like to remember that because I think a lot of times, this, you know, we watch the news and all we see are the bad parts.
Yes.
And I think it's really worth remembering, right? Just how far we've come,
yes.
and how much we're doing now, and we don't want to go back to the way things were because they were a lot less resources, especially for like special needs and such. And we don't want to go backwards; we want to go forwards. And I think, you know, schools help to remind us that there is a forward, that there mm-hmm. is a forward, and that's really an important part of what we can do as a board is we can make sure that there are training opportunities. One of the things that I'm very, very excited about is like we had a strategic plan for the first time. And part of the strategic plan, goal 3, was to provide these professional development opportunities. And one of the first professional development training that was given, and we committed to closing the schools early, so early dismissal, so that all teachers could be trained, was on a questioning technique. And questioning, being able to ask questions, being not afraid to ask questions, normalizing questioning,
yeah.
right? It's so important, not just about acquiring technical skills, which is important as well. I mentioned before at the debate that I went to a convention where someone was asking, "Oh, what is going to be the future programming language?" And you know, the presenter was like, "It's going to be English, because the AI is programming, and you need to ask the questions that will formulate clearly what is required for the AI to write the programming that you need, and being able to test to see if it's actually doing what you're, you know, then asking another question to refine the question, you know, and that continued process, asking questions." I really think it's great that our teachers are all trained at the same time, all on board to help our children ask better questions. I'd like to see us as a culture normalize questioning. As I mentioned before, like, I like teenagers because they were willing to ask questions.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost sometimes, and now that can change. Like, you know, our tweens also go through a self-conscious age as well. You know, this is when girls drop out of STEM, and, you know, like, there's all these, you know, all these issues. But I really want to normalize questioning so that we don't get ourselves stuck or going backwards or get ourselves in trouble. So I wanted to. Also, another thing that I really liked when I was living abroad was in Singapore, we had something called Racial Harmony Day. And I was at that time, I was like, I wish we had this. I wish we had this in the U.S. But we can start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Racial Harmony Day is all schools from 1 to the equivalent of 12 there. They have one day a year set aside to address diversity of race or religion or nationality or food if you're a child, or games or you know, political history, or, you know, like, whatever it is. But at age appropriate levels, it was okay to ask questions and dive into, like, how were these people treated differently at this time when this happened? You know, it was okay to find out and to know. And I feel like that was a big pressure release valve.
Yeah.
You know, one, it gave the opportunity to the kids to ask each other questions. You know, what does your parents say about this? Which is really important.
It is.
I didn't realize until I went to college that my African-American roommates had a completely different history or point of view than what I, you know,
right,
I was like,
oh, yeah.
Like, wait a second, I didn't realize this was happening. But to normalize this questioning part as children that we can do side by side all the way into adulthood, I think would be very, very good for our society.
I agree. I think that so much of the isolation that we find ourselves in that can exacerbate mental health issues,
yes,
is because we feel alone. And just being able for someone to ask, like, are you okay? Are you thinking about suicide? Like, very difficult questions being put out there into the world gives someone an opportunity to say, I need help.
Yes.
And to your point, the questions don't have to be that high stakes. We just can know each other a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Find the similarities, understand the differences, and move forward as a community instead of all of these different factions that we've come to find ourselves in, when we have so much more in common than we don't, period, across
absolutely
any dimension.
I always say we all bleed red.
Yes.
You know, thinking of that, one of the things that I really do love, I think we do fairly well, is that, you know, where we live, remarkably, 30% of the population is foreign born. So we do have a lot of diversity inherent, but we just not always have spaces to share that.
Yeah.
To bring, you know, to kind of cross fertilize and all that. We do have more than most, because just by the sheer numbers. But that's something I would love to see a lot more of. I think of, like, you know, for example, like, going to college, you know, universities in different parts of the world are accessible to us as Americans. I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, and they're actually more affordable.
Yes.
And so it's a really good thing to be able to share. So I love that our kids get to know one another, and they'll ask each other, what are you doing? Where are you applying? And we ended up with, I remember one year, 4 high school students going to Trinity College in Ireland. And not because we have 4 Irish students going to Trinity College, but because we have 1 Irish student and her 3 friends, you know, going. And that's great. She opened up, right, that option, that idea, you know, to make that possible. I'd love to see, like, the same kind of thing happen in more of the neurodiverse space as well. Mm-hmm. You know, how can neurodiverse people participate in more of the same activities, or if they're not able to do so safely, how can we do, you know, how can we include them? This year for our school musical, we had a for the first time, a separate day of performance for those that with sensory issues. So this was where you don't have like the bright spotlights and the, you know, and it, you know, they adjusted the sound and the lighting and such, and held it during the daytime and not in the nighttime, you know, and made it more accessible and open to the community and for anyone, you know, to who would come in who would like an experience that they could participate in and enjoy, where previously they might not have been able to have access. So I really like that. I'd love to see more of that. I think that's a really great idea.
Absolutely. And I think someone with your broad perspective and your very specific perspective as a parent really helps to bring that to life in the schools. Like when we have volunteers that have a diverse and broad perspective, then we all benefit from having that. For every student that might not know all these things or have been exposed to them, you're sharing, just like the Irish student shared Trinity
yes,
College.
That's right.
We're all better together.
Yes. It's really, it's the way it should be, right? I think, you know, I find the more I know people, the more I like them. And I think that's probably universally true.
Yeah.
I just don't have the opportunity to know everyone.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad I've gotten the chance to know you better today.
Hey, yes. In addition to the time that we can spend together outside.
Yes.
Thank you. Let me see. I just, you know, want to kind of be able to address a few things while I'm, you know, I'll have this time. I guess for those who are, you know, wondering, why am I doing this for another 3 years? Yes, it has been hard work. It absolutely has been hard work. It's been a steep learning curve. I've learned a lot. I've put a lot of time in to learning a lot. And that's also why I don't want it to go to waste. I want to make sure I can apply it right away. But also there are always things that we can do better. We have been doing a project in school to update our district manual, policy manual. For the first time, we're engaging the School Board Association to help us with that. It's been wonderful. They've been such a great help, and we're about halfway through, so I really, really do want to see that completed. I think that will, you know, education has changed a lot in the past 30-40 years. I think a lot, you know, I look at some of the dates, it seems like some of them date back from then, you know. So I think it's a good, worthwhile thing to do. It's not something that everybody is excited about. It's, you know, it's really detailed and you have to keep track of a lot of, you know, documents and stuff like that. But I do have the appetite for it. I think it's important. I think it has a long-term benefit for, you know, students for years and years. So it's a worthwhile thing to do.
Wow, that is amazing that you're taking that on. I mean, I've done similar work in very different environments and that's tough. It's very technical, very detailed. Like you said, not something most people have an appetite for, but you have the appetite and the aptitude.
I think we've been really fortunate. We have a lot of really great people. Our staff is fantastic. I was just looking at the budgets. We've just presented our budget for the last time this week. And then voters will go to vote on it on May 20th. I think it's wonderful. I mean, statewide, New York State holds all of the school board elections on the same day, right? Mm-hmm. So it's exactly a one-month period, which is great. Although I just observed elections in Singapore, and that was a two-week campaign period. But every year, even if there are no candidates up for elections, there's a budget to be voted on. It has to have the community's support, which is as it should be, right?
Yeah.
And so we don't move forward without people's support, and thankfully we have a very supportive community around education. It's something that I think I feel strongly about being a good steward of what the community, of the resources the community has entrusted us to, in order to provide, right, in order to help provide the education that they would want for their children.
I mean, that's amazing. And like you're saying, we all have a responsibility to participate as voters.
Mm-hmm.
There's opportunities for people to do more as they have the ability and the interest. And I am personally deeply grateful for you and other volunteers like you that take all of your great talents and dedicate them to making our community better, the next generation better. It's really inspirational.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm just grateful for my teachers. They were the ones who invested in me and showed me what life could be like, you know, where my parents did not know about civic participation, and my U.S. history teacher told me about that in high school and never thought, fast forward 20, 30 years, that it would be something that that I would be playing a role in back in the U.S. So,
That's so wonderful.
Let me see. I was just kind of, for those who might have questions about, what are the challenges that we foresee? And I think I would just speak to some of the big picture challenges. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone rightly will have some concerns about budget. We don't know how aid will be affected, federal level, state level, but also the federal government also provides a lot of aid to the states. So even that might affect the aid that we would get from the state. So nobody knows at this moment, but that's a big area of uncertainty. So it's just something that, we ask for everyone's patience as we're all having to also wait and find out. And other thing to recognize is just the demographics of where we are in New York State. People are having fewer children. Schools statewide have falling enrollment. And that's not something that one can wave a magic wand and fix. But it does mean, kind of going through your programs and your space and figuring out, how to provide those opportunities that your students, your students want and need. So that those are going to be ongoing, I think, just challenges for this, for every school in the state.
Yeah, these are crazy times. It's just another layer of complexity to what you're raising your hand to do.
Well, I had the sad experience because I do have friends still living overseas and their children are considering university or graduate school, and the U.S. was on the radar screen. And unfortunately, because of concerns about visas and stuff, none of them considered continuing their education in the U.S. And I'm very sad about that. I mean, for a number of reasons, is like, I think we have a lot to learn from those students. They have a lot to learn from us as well. This cross-fertilization, exactly what we want, on both sides. The other thing is that these students are often fully sponsored by their countries or companies or and such. And so it would have helped our schools as well. So it's what it is. I'm hoping that our friendships are more durable. And that we will be able to, work together in some way. If it's not in the immediate future, that at least the rest of the world continues collaborating and working together and not losing some of the, the insights that might come from working in a diverse team and having a broad range of ideas and skills to pull from. And that can continue until we have the opportunities in the U.S. to participate in that process again. So,
it's a moment that I hope that we can recover from quickly for so many reasons.
I guess for those who don't know what a school board member's role is, maybe I could speak a little bit to that.
Sure, okay? Of course.
So I like to explain it with an analogy. So most of you are familiar with the idea that there's a company and a company has a board of a board of trustees and the board of trustees oversees the CEO of the company. But the company is run by the CEO, who then basically hires all the rest of the staff. It's similar in that in a company, the shareholders select the board of trustees, whereas in a school district or municipality as well, it's the electorate, right, that would select their representatives, who would then supervise general oversight over the superintendent in our case, or the, mayor or something, in a municipal government. And in New York State, that's pretty clearly defined, which I'm really grateful for, by the way, the clarity of New York State. Really is fantastic. And that mainly comes down to overseeing the budget, choosing and evaluating the superintendent, and the policy manual. Which is just to provide the broad framework, hopefully to reflect what is important in our community as well, but the framework for under which the superintendent then operates and administers all his resources and have his staff operate under. So it's a very, I like how democratic it is. I like how that even if you're not a you don't have to be a homeowner. You could be a renter, right? You have you live here, you vote, you have the opportunity four times to hear the budget and ask questions. It's just a remarkably inclusive opportunity. I feel when we lived abroad, we didn't have these opportunities. And I think people would be amazed to have these opportunities that, wait, you can choose to have smaller class sizes.
Right.
Right. Your community can choose to do that. You know, and people would love that, you know, where in some of the places that we lived in. It's like, love to have a say to be able to choose, you know, to have smaller class sizes. So I feel very grateful that we have those opportunities. I think we're in the business of education, and most of education is administered by people, right? Not machines. It's not furniture that teaches you. It's not, you know, it's people. And so not surprisingly, staff salaries and benefits are the largest part of our budget. So that's about 75% for Rhinec. I think it's about 80% for Mamaroneck. And I think that shows the priorities, right? The priority that we place in a face-to-face educational environment. I think it's so important, especially for language acquisition. I think that was one of the things that we missed out, right, during COVID, was seeing the muscles move and hearing the aspirations and knowing where to place your tongue and and using those muscle groups. And that's what people were concerned about, you know, with loss education. But I think we've done so much to make sure learning happens back, you know, in person, having groups, small groups, pull-out groups, you know, to address, you know, those who need more help. I'm grateful for the community's support for that.
Yeah. No, and it's a good reminder of, you know, the democratic core of what we're talking about and one of the great things about this country. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
I feel like we got to do this again because we could keep talking for hours.
Thank you so much.